This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and tonight I have a special guest for the show who I'll tell you about in a little minute. Tonight we've got two sponsors for the show, the first being Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect and review student work and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, grades and more. And our second sponsor is Jam Software, who provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhone and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com, and we'll tell you about both of those as the show goes on. So tonight my guest is Dr. Liam Marks, University teacher in medical genetics at the University of Glasgow. Leah is one of the leading people at Glasgow University involved in MOOCs, MOOCs being short for Massively Open Online Course. And I thought it was very interesting what she's been working on, and I wanted to bring her on the show to talk to her about what MOOCs are for a start, and then how she sees MOOCs playing out in the traditional world of academia and how things might change as time goes on. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Leah. So Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about you and mm-hmm. your background and what you do?
Yep, sure. So I am a university teacher in medical genetics at the University of Glasgow. I came at this from a research background, so a research background in developmental cell biology and looking at preeclampsia, so a very different background to what I'm doing now. From that, after about 6 years of that, I then moved into genetics teaching within the university. And at the moment, I'm involved in a teaching-based role within the medical school at the university. And that involves both postgraduate and undergraduate teaching, as well as research into teaching, sort of scholarship of education type.
Okay. So the title university teacher is, people will be familiar with lecturer and reader in terms like that, but university teacher is more of a, you're more focused on teaching graduates and undergraduates.
It's essentially a teaching-based role with the remit of scholarship rather than say, genetics-based research. Okay. It would be research into teaching methods.
Okay, so it's more about moving the university teaching mission forward rather than the research aspect. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you're working in medical genetics as a whole.
Yeah.
I was interested, you told me years ago, we talked about this because we've been friends for years and years, you told me that your subject doesn't exist without computers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole thing is based, and much more so even now than the past, you know, it is impossible to imagine genetics without computers.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. And when I'm teaching things like exponential growth and things like that, the Human Genome Project is one of the classic case studies of,
exactly.
You know, 8 years into the project, only 10% was done, and then Moore's Law took care of the rest in the last couple of years.
I think the whole of almost all of biological fields are like that, but especially genomic research. You just, the vast amounts of data that's been created, you just would have no hope of doing anything with it without computing.
Interestingly, I mean, how much would you say that a genetics researcher would actually write programs themselves to analyse that, or would they use commercial tools?
Yeah, it's a funny one because I think there's almost like now two branches. There's the geneticists who are the sort of lab-based people, and you get a whole subset of people who are really terrified of the idea of the analysis, the computing-based stuff. Yeah. And then you've got another whole group of people who, that's what the line they really want to go down. I think almost undergraduate education as well is becoming, you know, such that there is an element of that in it now, that you have, if you want to go into it in a serious way, you have to understand some of the computing. But there's a lot of people within it currently who, they just don't want to go near that, and you'll sort of give it to somebody who has a much more sort of specialist role.
But so it's almost like the split between theoretical and practical physics, almost, isn't it?
Yep, totally.
Yeah, it's becoming quite abstract.
Yeah,
So we're just manipulating sequences of data in the computer rather than actually, you know, not even a living organism. It's just, you
Yeah, you've now got geneticists whose whole role is in front of a computer the whole day. You know, they're not doing anything that's in a lab that people would imagine a traditional scientist doing.
Yeah. It's very abstract, isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, the reason we wanted to talk to you, Leah, tonight was more about your work with MOOCs and that kind of university teaching aspect of your profession. And I guess my introductory question to that is, how has university teaching changed in the time that you've been doing it, or receiving it for that matter, you know, since you were an undergraduate?
I mean, that is, I suppose that's now, what, 20 years since I started as an undergrad. I think there's two things. I think one of them is that the whole concept of the didactic lecture, massive, you know, kind of groups of students sitting in a lecture theatre, the information, me talking about it for an hour and then receiving it for an hour, and that's the end of it. I think that is more and more going out. But I think, I suspect it's probably going out more because of student expectations. So I think that's more, maybe that's more driven by the almost consumer type student, you know, feeling now that the student is a consumer and you as the educator, it's almost a product they're buying in a way. No longer do they just want somebody that talks at them for an hour. They want really kind of to understand what you're doing.
Yeah, I was at a university admissions conference a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking a lot about the it was the UCAS people who coordinate the admissions, and they were talking a lot about some of the things that universities are doing to sort of incentivize the students. It was all about the student experience. It was you know, only a little bit of it was about how much you'll learn or what you'll do. You know, it was all about who's got the best halls and the other one was, well, what can you trade off in return for making then your first choice? You know, so there was stuff about so-called incentivized admissions as well. So I think that, I mean, that's one big change, I think, nationwide since we were students at university is the idea. You know, when we started, I think, in sort of the mid-90s, it was very much, you were very lucky to go to university and you took whatever was given very much. But I think even just very quickly after we started, the changes in funding and things like that, and now, of course, the fees as well, the students expect a lot more.
They're
buying a product and they're kind of aware of it, I think, aren't they?
And I think with that, the sort of idea of some, you know, ancient person who's been doing research for years and years, who's a wonderful researcher, who just turns up with no preparation and delivers somebody else's slides for an hour with no input, no skill and no sort of, you know, I don't know, no kind of finesse at it. I think that that's gone out the window, and you really are expected as a teacher or a lecturer to be a professional and be developing very much the CPD kind of route, all that sort of stuff, and also doing research into your teaching to see what's effective and what isn't a good way of teaching, all tied up with the student as consumer type notion.
Interesting. So you're saying that the lecture is kind of heading out, you know, is there still a place for that kind of teaching at all? Or do you see that as, is it to do with length or is it to do with
I think
style?
I think it's a lot to do with, it's a luxury not to be able to teach in that way. You know, in the medical school, I think about it, we've maybe 250 students a year, undergrads. In some respects, there is some content that you can only deliver to them by lecture. You can't take everybody into small groups for absolutely every single thing.
You're never going to get through first year psychology on a small group basis. That's the biggest course. Is that still the biggest course at university?
Yeah, I think so. 900,
yeah,
I think.
Astronomical numbers. So, I mean, in some ways, the lecture is the lowest cost.
It's always going to be there, I think, to some degree. And also, I think there's some content that is suited to it. You know, there's some stuff that is just very, very factual information that if you can deliver it in an hour to 300 people, it's probably worth it money-wise.
Yeah, instead of waiting for 300 people to discover it themselves and
to learn
a journey of discovery.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I think it has a place.
So there's still a place, but you're increasingly seeing things going digital.
Yes.
I mean, getting you on the show was partly inspired by a conversation with another mutual friend of ours who's a lecturer in physiotherapy, and she was saying that the lecture is almost dead. Not in the sense that lecture teaching is necessarily going away, but like the lectures are being delivered by video.
We've gone down that route just recently. Firstly, I think with our third year medics, and now with our first year medics last year for the first time. But I was certainly really interested in the fact that I was coordinating a 4-week block in the undergrad curriculum, and they asked me to coordinate who would give their permission to be recorded, etc. And I was very surprised at the high level of resistance to actually being recorded.
Interesting.
Lots and lots of people. I didn't cross my mind not to be recorded. It wouldn't bother me in the slightest, but an awful lot of people are very resistant to being recorded.
Did they give you specific reasons that you can share?
Some of it was copyright. Some of them were afraid. I think, don't even think they were afraid of copyright. I think they just felt they didn't understand the copyright laws.
Yeah, and they didn't want
to go there. Somebody else, said, I don't have the time. I'm delivering a 1-hour lecture, but I'm a researcher. I don't have the time to spend hours and hours on just working out these images. I think the other thing is people feel if they put their lecture online, then less students will come to their lecture, whether or not that's a bad thing.
I suppose you don't know yet whether
you don't know whether that's whether that. I think there is some evidence that it isn't actually true, but whether it's a bad thing if they watch it at home or they're watching it.
I slightly suspect that people who don't come to the virtual lectures wouldn't have come to the physical lecture.
Totally. And it'd be quite, I don't know if it'd be flattering or not to see if people had watched your lecture lots. That might indicate people didn't understand it first time and you've not delivered it well. Or
those raw stats can be pretty brutal.
So I don't know. We're still very much in the infancy of all that, I think.
So, I mean, I remember when I first looked at iTunes U, one of the first things I looked at was a chemistry course from Duke University, about which I knew nothing. You know, it was not my area at all. But I just remember it because the first video I downloaded and I turned on was a single camera at the back of the hall with a professor at the front writing on an overhead projector. I was like, well, these technologies are not quite marrying up in the way I thought they might. So, you know, those first sort of digital initiatives were just about, you know, putting a camera. It was kind of like when cinema was invented, you know, we put a camera in front of the stage and did a play.
Yes.
You know, and it's a wee bit the same right now. Are we doing any better?
I think in some people are. I think this is the thing, is the quality at the moment is very mixed. You know, you've got some people who just, I suppose, have the facilities or the people, the expertise to do it well. And you have other people who do it abominably, you know, just a camera in the office sitting, you know, with
the classic Open University Saturday morning videos from 1981, you know.
I mean, some of them are terrible, but some of them are really nice quality.
And do you think that that'll have an impact over time in terms of recruitment? I mean, I'm kind of feeling my way towards the idea of like who does a MOOC
I know one of the things we looked at when we were looking at doing MOOCs in the first place was that we were using a particular one of the platforms and that the idea was that they would be very high quality in order to create, I suppose, an impression, create as a marketing tool, I guess, which, and that was supposed to be in comparison with some of the other platforms where the quality isn't necessarily so good. That was one of the focuses of the platform that our university chose, was supposed to be these really high quality videos. And I think they have kept to it reasonably.
Okay. Let me break in here and tell you about Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can easily assign, collect and review student work in their iPads and then provide rich feedback directly onto documents with annotation features such as the pen tool and text and voice notes. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of iPad apps or by using Shobi's built-in tools. New to Shobi this year is the gradebook feature for Shobi Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review and export student grades. More great features like student portfolios and parent access are coming to Shobi this fall. Shobi Basic is 100% free, and individual teachers listening to this podcast will get gradebook and the enhanced annotation features of Shobi Pro for 30% off if they purchase annually. Start your paperless classroom today by downloading Shobi in the App Store or visiting shobi.com. That's shobie.com. So in terms of, you mean the phrase MOOC, we've used, you know, massively open online course. Like, how massive are we getting?
That's a fascinating one. So there's the three big players. There's Coursera, edX. Well, the two big players are Coursera and edX, various others in the States and things. But in the UK, the main one here is FutureLearn. So that's one we're using. And massive for us, the biggest course FutureLearn's had, I think, is around 100,000.
Okay.
Which was one run by the British Council, actually, interestingly, on preparing for IELTS testing. So that is where you need a certain score in order, if you're a speaker of another language, in order to get into a UK university or for a whole range of different things. So preparing for those kind of tests, I think, was the biggest one they've done so far.
That's interesting.
I think in some of the big edX Coursera ones, I think you are talking millions of people potentially. But that's certainly the biggest. Some of them, one I'm enrolled on just now on a completely different platform, there's 2,500 learners. So, you know, massive is, I guess, is all relative.
Yeah, but it's all relative, I suppose, to what one institution could do.
Yeah.
On a physical basis. Yeah.
I mean, I've taught more students in the two runs of my own MOOC, I've taught more students than are currently enrolled at the university. You know, which It was a really bizarre thought.
I think I had a similar experience when I looked at, when we had put out some early iTunes U courses, and I looked at the number. We had one that was just called Using iTunes U and iBooks Together, or something like that. And when I looked at the stats for that course, I realized that every week we were signing up more people had downloaded that course or subscribed to it every week than had ever been a student at our school.
It's where
physical education meets internet scale.
Yep.
And it just gets a bit weird.
Yeah, you can't. And also you have no concept of those numbers. 300 people in a lecture theatre sitting in front of me, I can imagine. But I can't imagine the fact that I'm reaching 7,000 for each of those courses.
Yeah.
It's quite a...
It does get confusing at that point, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So how do academics see a MOOC? I mean, you're talking about people coming at it as a kind of lost leader almost.
Yeah.
For the brand.
I think there's... Again, possibly quite polarised views on it. I think there's a lot of scepticism amongst a lot of, not just, you know, our own institution. I think in general, there's a lot of, is this just the next kind of big hype that's going to go away eventually?
Is the internet just going to go away?
Yes, I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. The answer is no. But you've got the other set of people that, I suppose, which I would say I'm in that kind of camp where I see it as something useful. But I think we need to work out what we're doing with it and where we're going with it. Because I don't think that necessarily needs to be decided, you know, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of thing that will take a lot of time to see where we're going with this type of education. What its impact is actually going to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also there's a lot of academics who just don't really even know about them.
Mm.
So that is still within ours. We've run two MOOCs in the university, and there's another maybe five or six, I think, in the pipeline. But, you know, if that was maybe 10 academics involved in mine, you think how many thousands or hundreds of academics there are at the University of Glasgow.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot who really don't have much.
It's just not in the orbit,
you know,
the vast majority of the staff so far.
Yep, I think so.
So you're looking at maybe a 20-year horizon or something, aren't you?
Yep. You're looking at a long while before it... necessarily becomes embedded as part of something that universities do, unless something happens that springs into much more mainstream education.
Yeah. Try to think what that could be.
I know. I mean, what we're looking at the moment with our one, so our MOOC was on the topic of cancer. So it's a 6-week MOOC on cancer. And we're now looking at using that as part of the medical curriculum.
Okay.
So for 5 weeks in their second and third year, our medical undergrads undertake a topic of their own choice, and I coordinate part of that. So I'm looking to recruit, you know, two students to go to dermatology, two students to go to anatomy, two students to go where, you know, right across Glasgow. And if you think about trying to do that for 260 students, that's an awful lot of coordination. So what I'm looking at now is, can I take 30 students to do my MOOC as their special study module? And if you look at even just the Future Learn platform, there's lots of MOOCs out there that could be really relevant to medical education. So therefore, could we use some of them as, you know, potential these short courses? So you're taking what's the content that's been created, and you're then using that as part of an established program.
So that seems to be like it's the first thing I've heard about where completion of a MOOC to some extent actually confers. Academic credit,
yes,
if you like.
Yeah,
because it's always been one of my sort of concerns about MOOCs is that, like, it's great to learn that stuff, but unless you've got a degree from Glasgow University, you can't be a doctor.
Yes, that's,
you
know, no use.
You don't
to
get
to
be a doctor just because you've been through
done a MOOC.
I wouldn't take that
nice.
Surgery. Yeah,
yeah.
So that's quite interesting. That door's starting to open.
Yeah, I think as well, a door that is starting to open is that you can do a MOOC and you can come and sit a test. Some accredited centre, and get a certificate for that. Or you can just buy a certificate for having completed the steps. I mean, we charge 30 quid to buy a certificate for having completed the steps. And you are starting now to filter through to see people who are including that in their CV as well. So their application to medicine.
That's interesting.
Application to a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think you can only judge that favourably if somebody's bothered to do 6 weeks of a course then. You know,
it's kind of like a slightly more intellectual Duke of Edinburgh.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, What about, talk to me about completion rates, which is always one of the big sticks.
That's a big key. It's always the media kind of hype of MOOCs is the completion rate. Yeah, so completion rates are pretty low, of about, say, 3,000, 3,500 people who are actually properly doing the MOOC, although you've got 7,500 registered, 3,500. You'd be lucky if you got 1,000 of them completing.
Okay.
So you're lucky 20, 30% completion rates are looked on in this sort of whole industry has been really good, which part of that obviously seems really low. You know, if you did a 20% completion rate on any course in a university, I mean, you would just be...
If you had that as a proper rate, you'd be getting chancellor.
You'd be, you'd be gone in a minute. But being a dropout myself, I think I look on it in a slightly different way because I've enrolled, maybe 20 or 30 MOOCs and I've yet to complete one. But I've definitely got out of quite a few of them what I wanted out of them. So, you know, there's a whole idea of if you don't read a newspaper cover to cover, you know, is that it'd been a waste of a newspaper. But I think there's definitely a retention problem. I think there's a group in there that are just dropping out because they don't have time or they, you know, don't want to do it, which is fair enough. I think there's also a group in there that we could potentially keep. But the question is it worth the effort that you would need in order to keep them?
The areas you'd have to do beyond just delivering the content and the platform.
Of the course, do you? High. And what is your purpose in trying to keep them? You know, if they don't want to do it, are you, you know, is there any point in that?
And I suppose one of the differences between the physical experience of being at university and being on a MOOC is that the marginal cost to the university is so low. Of being on, having another student on the MOOC versus having another student taking up a seat in the lecture theatre.
I mean, if you have 7,000 students on MOOC, and I think initially we invested about 7,000, something like that, I mean, you're talking a pound per student, you know, for your overall investment in it. So, ridiculously low sums.
It makes you wonder, in the age of, you know, reducing education budgets and things like that, you know, because in Scotland we have this odd situation with its free tuition, but only for so many. You know, that is this maybe the thing that opens the doors? Could everybody go to university in principle?
In principle,
If we just redefine the idea of what it is
to be at university, is the on-campus experience really what being at university actually is? I think in our minds it probably is, because that's how it was in the 90s kind of thing, you know, when we went to university.
The Greeks invented that kind of education,
But is the intellectual content, is that enough? And theoretically it should be enough, you know, the intellectual.
It's the difference between reading a book and getting FaceTime with an academic, isn't it? But that's the thing that doesn't scale.
The FaceTime with the academic doesn't. And I think for their first run of the MOOC, we've run it twice. For the first run, we basically tried to do the almost FaceTime with the academics. So we answered questions. We had people on shifts morning, noon and night answering the questions of the students. Whereas this time we did it, we didn't have that. And it'll be interesting to see how that affects completion rates.
Did you get feedback?
We did have some feedback from people saying, you're not answering our questions all the time. But
were any of those people who had maybe come back from the first run?
No, actually, interestingly, I don't think they were. I think they were people who'd done other MOOCs and who said other... Somebody said to me specifically, you know, another university answers every question, goes through every step every day, whereas you don't. You say that you only go through this week's steps to answer the questions. You know, this isn't a good service.
So you're getting competition for something
that's
free.
Getting competition for something that's free,
Well, that's kind of like the App Store economics brought to education, isn't it? You know, it's like,
this free app
isn't good enough, one star, you know.
That's right, this free MOOC that's...
What a time to be alive. So what about assessment? Like you said that there were certificates for completion, certificates for, you know, and the potential of coming to a testing centre or something and going beyond.
So, I mean, that's actually my area of research on the MOOC, is the assessment. So there's two main ways at the moment. So at the end of each week, or the end, various steps during a week, you have multiple choice quiz questions, which obviously lends itself to certain subjects. You know, that I can't imagine how you do that in English literature. You know, no concept of how you do that.
Who's the bad guy in Dracula?
That's the only thing I could think of. But I can do that perfectly well in cancer. That's easy as anything. Cancer genetics, I can write multiple choice questions, you know, so they're coming out of my ears. So that's how I do that. You can come to a test centre for some courses and do 100 multiple choice, mm-hmm. you know, exams, similar thing, and actually yeah. get credit. But the other thing, which is what we're, I suppose, looking into more, is peer review. Mm-hmm. So the idea that you give them a task to do, ask them to write, for us it was 300 words on the epigenetics involved in cancer,
okay.
and then the system automatically switches over to somebody else to look at and to make comment on. We didn't ask mm-hmm. the other student to grade because we didn't really feel that was the best way to go about it. Mm-hmm. We asked the other student to comment, you know, highlight areas of weakness, highlight good points, mm-hmm. etc. And then that student gets that back from their peer, which creates quite a lot of aggro in some instances, but also some people love it and yeah. the comments on it. Some people really find that very useful exercise.
Are the people who are unhappy because they feel that they're not getting their work seen by somebody who really knows?
Or... Well, interestingly, they felt that they weren't, quite a few people felt they weren't qualified to review other people's work.
Oh, really?
So how yeah. can I tell what my, if my peers' work's good or not?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not an expert in this subject, that kind of comment.
That's what happens when you take a primary teacher's technique and play it up to the level yes, of people who are self-aware enough to yeah. know that they don't know.
Yeah, they don't, yeah exactly. Yeah. Also, what's interesting is the amount of plagiarism, which is what we're looking at,
really?
In something like that. So, you know, what benefit is somebody getting from cutting and pasting something from Wikipedia in something that they're not being assessed on, they're only doing for self-development? You know, yeah, you do wonder.
Getting the idea yeah.
You can understand plagiarism in something that's been graded and you're, mm-hmm. you know, getting a mark for it and get something yeah. out of, but something that's just for intrinsic self-benefit and worth, you know, how does copying and pasting
do the platforms do anything about that?
No, not at the moment at all.
Yeah.
It's just that we're doing research into it.
Interesting.
To look at plagiarism.
I remember the UCAS thing they were talking about, personal statements.
And
there's plagiarism detection software working at that level for people's personal statements that kind of explain, for people who don't know what that is, it's a supporting statement that goes along with your university application. And they were trying to filter out plagiarized versions or automated writing versions there. Mm-hmm. But what was very funny was that we got a letter in at the school from a company who were selling software, not to defeat the plagiarism detection, but to optimize your personal statement for what they're looking for. And this had been written by somebody who used to work for this organization and had seen all the personal statements and knew what they were looking for. And it was basically like search engine optimization for your personal statement for university. So the algorithm war is beginning. You know?
Yeah.
And it's not going to go
That's
away.
That's impressive.
I don't think. Yeah. Great. So, we've talked about MOOCs, we've talked about, you know, how academics see them, how students respond to them. What about, how far down do you think this can go?
Mm-hmm.
That's my next question, right? Do you think this, does this technique, can you perfect this to the point where you could do things for schools?
In terms of providing content for mm-hmm. schools? Yeah. I think that will come because people want to use MOOCs as an advert, mm-hmm. as a marketing tool. I heard of one university, not quite the school context, but one university that had cut its overseas travel budget for marketing mm-hmm. to, say, Middle Eastern universities because they were now targeting that market through MOOCs. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that is what people will start to do with MOOCs for schools, because I think, from what we've seen anyway, we're getting a whole broad range of people. Some that are interested, 1 out of 7,000 might come to the university and we've got no way of tracking it. But I think if you can create a product that schools want, mm-hmm. you have a potential to tap into what is your, you know, ideal market.
Yeah.
You know, that's the...
So you're talking about possibly like advanced hires?
Yeah.
As a MOOC with the brand of your university on
Yes, exactly.
Which then...
Yeah, I mean that then...
Many gears are turning in my head. Thinking about that.
That then brings your university floating up to the top of the mm-hmm. what people notice. You know, and you've done your 6 year or whatever, you've done a course from a certain university, I think you're much more likely to think, mm-hmm. oh, that sounds like an interesting university. They're already doing that in Future Learn at preparing for university. There's a course called Preparing for University, mm-hmm. which is marketed at A-level students, I think, it's down south. You
sponsored
know.
By the University of Warwick or something.
Yeah, I mean,
like
it is. It's one of the one of the universities down south. There's other ones writing your CV, things like that. They are, you know, clearly targeting a market that's obviously one of the universities kind of captive audience.
Yeah, particularly in Scotland, where student recruitment ends up being a sort of zero-sum game.
Yeah, I mean,
because of the numbers cap.
Yep.
You know, the yeah. hard limits on those yeah. numbers. Whereas in England, it's quite different.
It's much more a free-for-all.
Those caps have all gone now.
So you can you can market.
Is buy one, get one free time down in England. By comparison, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's very interesting. I know there are some schools, we were at a thing, I think it was maybe again with UCAS or another organisation, mm-hmm. where there was people from schools there and they were talking about university school partnerships mm-hmm, that they had set up.
Mm-hmm.
Some school in Aberdeen, I think it was, with Robert Gordon's up
right,
there.
Okay.
They had 6-year pupils who had a lot of slack time in their timetable mm-hmm. were going to the university like one day a month or something and getting a university experience there.
Yeah.
And it'd be quite interesting to see if that can be scaled.
Yes, into
on the internet rather than
the internet. Yeah. I mean, I know some of the like not so much I suppose undergraduate but postgraduate levels. So mm-hmm. the University of Strathclyde did one of the very early successful MOOCs was a forensics one they did. Mm-hmm. I think they had something like 28,000 students on it, which at the time was huge.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, they've got a master's programme in forensics.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that
very
is tapping,
well known for that course.
Yeah, and that's tapping directly into a potentially big market. I don't know what they're capped or anything, mm-hmm. but, you know, you're potentially, you bring in one student, and that's £15,000 potentially for
that's
your...
That's paid for your investment.
Yeah,
in
that's
MOOC
totally
right
paid
there.
For it and more.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Especially if you run the MOOC more than once, you know, you are getting your money back. Although it's very hard to track.
Yeah.
You know,
it's hard to track for now, though. But, I mean, you could imagine mm-hmm. that if MOOCs could be given a course code the same way that you know, exams are given a course code, and that appears on your UCAS application form.
Yes, yeah.
You know, there's your that's your connector.
Yep. And you can track its success.
Tracking, yeah.
And especially, I think, as well, as we go more online with our masters, I know it's mm-hmm. one of our big drivers at the moment, is we're trying to get a lot more master's programmes online mm-hmm. within our school. So as you do that, potentially people that have come through the MOOC route will be more likely to do an online master's than maybe mm-hmm. to uproot their family from, you know, whichever country they're in and come to Scotland just to do a course. But if you can register for something online, I think that's much more likely to tap into your MOOC market.
Interesting.
These are people as well, obviously, that are used to using this type of learning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not potentially so bothered about actually coming and working in the lab. You know, they're quite happy getting their stuff.
And of course, universities over the past 15 to 20 years have, particularly British universities, have spent a lot of time and effort in expanding their brand into other countries.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are actually branded campuses across the world with
loads
British university names on them. Harriet Watt being one that I know of. And,
sure we've got branches in various places in the world, or certainly courses within other universities in various places in the world.
That carry that accreditation.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. You can see where that's all going.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you about Jam Software. Jam Software provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhone and Apple TV in education. Now with Casper Focus, they've placed these great technologies directly into the hands of the teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select the specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jamsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. You're talking about the kind of person who is used to learning that way.
Yeah.
Can you characterise that kind of person in any way? That's a hard question, I know.
Yeah.
When you've got 10,000 people, but...
I mean, I thought that you would be able to characterise them more
mm-hmm.
accurately. We get a pre-course survey that starts. We can look at demographics of age. Are you working? What type of work are you in? You know, mm-hmm. all kinds of different things. And I suppose I did expect it to be more either younger people and retired people. That was my expectation. Right. That's who would be doing the MOOC. But actually it's not at all. You know, it's spread out through the ages. We have quite a lot of people doing our one, I suppose, maybe more from a CPD point of view, mm-hmm. who are already working in science lab-based type roles,
okay.
you know, maybe want to go into cancer in more depth. Whereas I thought it would be older retired people who were learning to use a computer and whose mother had cancer.
Mm, but, some life event.
Yeah, a life event, but it doesn't seem to be. It seems much more to be people of all ages, all demographics. I think we had something like 40 countries or something, you know. I mean, there's obviously countries where it's concentrated,
yeah.
but it's not particularly, you know, one type of person.
From what you're saying, it sounds like it's already just beyond sort of kicking the tires, casual interest people.
Yeah, yep, definitely. It's definitely people that have got some kind of motivation for doing it. And I suppose, I mean, I look at why I do. I've done different MOOCs. I took up one recently in using R for doing data analysis because I needed that for my job.
Yeah.
You know, found it very difficult. But, you know, that was the reason I was doing it. It wasn't just a sort of casual, oh, I'll see what this is. There was thought behind why I was doing it.
That was the reason I signed up for my only ever MOOC was casual interest. I signed up for the most grandiose one I could think of, which was it was Introduction to Complexity Theory at the Santa Fe Institute.
Wow.
Which sounds amazing, right? You used to say it sounds great. You know, I'd love to say I completed it, but I never did.
I want to know who the completers are, what type of person it is.
What is it gets you through to the end of that? You know, is it? There's obviously some level of self-motivation involved in there, which as a school teacher, I think, you know the students who would benefit from that, but you also know that there's a good substantial chunk of people who
wouldn't benefit.
That's not suitable for.
I think similar to that, there's a famous study somewhere, I think, in the West Coast of America, where they looked at using MOOCs as a kind of remedial tool for students who basically had failed in a particular course, and they looked at, they gave these students the link and said, here's the MOOC, this will teach you the basics of algebra or whatever it was, but they found it made absolutely no difference. I think the students even got worse.
Really?
So they were showing you that they were the students who already weren't motivated, and giving them a MOOC to do didn't make them any more motivated. So it's almost like for a MOOC, you are looking at some kind of intrinsic motivation within the person. And if that's not there, then
it's
not actually, it's not given any benefit. Because that would be an ideal tool if you could use it. If you had students who were failing in a basic area of biology, I could just send them back to do a MOOC, you know, in cell biology, but that doesn't necessarily work.
Do you think pedagogy has to change as a result of what's, what's now possible?
I think it does, but I think we're quite slow to do it. I think it's very easy for us just to look at the traditional way of doing things and go, right, okay, let's put that online and let's do it the same. I think one thing that came out of sort of the whole for the pedagogy for me and doing our MOOC was that I saw the benefit of doing things in chunks. So all our MOOC videos are about 8 minutes, whereas I'm used to hour long lectures all the time.
Yeah.
And that has definitely changed the way I teach in terms of I'm much better at chunking things now.
Interesting. That's something you have to really practice, isn't it?
Yep. I don't think people's concentration span, I think I've realised how an hour is a ridiculous time to talk at people for.
Yeah, and I think it perhaps it always was, but we just it was just too easy to organise your school or university day around hour chunks, wasn't it?
Totally, yeah.
Because the cost of, I suppose, the time cost of moving around the campus.
Yeah, you want to bring everybody in for 8 minute slots. Yeah. I mean, that's obviously never going to work.
That would be quite a timetabling task. Yeah.
There must be a way to do your teaching so that you're still chunking it, but in the same way you do in a MOOC, but, you know, within a kind of on-campus context.
Yeah, that's interesting. Can you see a day where MOOCs, where people come in and just do the MOOC on campus?
Do the MOOC? In pieces, yeah. I think if it's cheaper to recruit, if it's less expensive to just have this expert from somewhere teach the MOOC, potentially buy it in. There's been talk in MOOC world of, you know, even companies buying in MOOCs to train their staff. So I think if you can buy in a MOOC that somebody's created on, maybe it was on our, you know, programming language, whatever, then rather than bringing in an expert on a full-time contract to teach that forever and ever, why not get your students to do a six-week MOOC on it?
It's fascinating.
As an option. You know, if they want, some people might want to do that, some people might not.
It's kind of like your journal subscription, but for the rest of the university.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah, totally.
Yeah, because, I mean, universities and schools do buy in plenty of expertise in lots of different areas. But that's kind of starting to eat into the core mission a little bit, isn't it?
Interesting. I know, I think it could... I think it would take quite a kind of shift in thinking before that, because I think there's a lot of resistance to that kind of, you know, this will make lecturers, you know, unnecessary, that whole sort of school of thought, you know, why do we need a university in the first place? I think all that school of thought gives a lot of resistance to that idea.
Yeah.
But
maybe what happens is that a new university arises, which from day one is just based on MOOCs.
It's based on MOOCs,
Yeah.
And then other people see, oh, that works.
That's very interesting. Because the universities are, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems to me the universities are a little bit like newspapers used to be, where you had two businesses going side by side. You had the news business and you had the classified ads.
Yep.
And the classified ads were the thing that generated all the revenue to pay for the loss-making news. And, you know, undergrad teaching and research kind of have this, they live together in this weird way. Where if all the undergrad teaching goes away, goes online, then you've got this sort of half a wall of research edifice.
How's it all going?
I know there's grants and things.
I mean, I suppose, I suppose that's the thing. There's a, which is bringing, I suppose in some areas it's different. I suppose in some of the medical research, you know, that I can see it, there's a huge amounts of money coming in from that. But I suppose in maybe some other areas where there's less research money coming in, the, the students are what's holding it up. So if you lose them, but then maybe you just charge people for the content in the same way you charge them for the, you know, coming to a class and sitting in.
£15,000 to join your MOOC.
Yeah,
that would fix your retention rates.
That would be
that would be
pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I think the whole thing needs a rethink. I think it's very much in its infancy in terms of what we actually do with it long term. But I think there's a lot of potential for it. It just needs people to kind of, you know, think through a bit more and not sort of, not kind of respond to the hype. So the hype one way or the other, you know, this is the end of the world or this is the be all and end all. I think it definitely needs some kind of middle road of, right, okay, it's neither of them, but what are we actually going to do with the content? Because there's some fabulous content being created. And there's no point in reinventing the wheel to teach the same content if it's already there. But it's how you integrate
How do you differentiate your university's content from
somebody.
The generic baseline knowledge in the field? And then there's a question about how far should you do that? Because then if people are coming out with, you know, a very esoteric view of the field because you've tried to differentiate very hard, but they don't know the basic equations that keep the building from falling down, then we're all in a lot of trouble, you know?
Yeah, there needs to be some basics. Somebody needs to cover the basics somewhere. Yeah. And I suppose that's what we've done. Ermic, we've covered, I mean, nothing of what we've covered until maybe the very last week is particularly specific to Glasgow. But in Glasgow, in the second last and last weeks, we kind of focus a bit more on, you know, say pancreatic cancer, which is one of Glasgow's big researches. But weeks 1 to 4, you know, it's very generic cell biology, which any Joe Bloggs that was involved in any kind of cancer research could teach. So that wasn't specifically Glasgow marketed, branded content, if you like.
It wasn't something we'd come to you specially to learn.
In the University of Bath did a very similar one. But certainly in weeks 5 and 6, we did try to advertise Glasgow's speciality, I suppose, if you like. But
Maybe that's the way it goes, because universities do have already reputations for specialisation in certain areas, you know, in, like, in computer science, you think of robotics or computer vision, you think of the University of Edinburgh, for example, you know, things like that. Glasgow, a little bit more about human factors. I'm probably 20 years out of date what I'm saying here. I mean, these things do endure, I suppose, don't they?
You know? I suppose it's like Strathclyde with its forensics, or university had a big one on equine nutrition, which again, you know, nobody else does in depth particularly, but
there's there be enough demand for a course like that.
Bizarrely, I think it was one of their highest completion rates. But I suppose if you do one like that, you've got a motivation for doing it, you know.
And if that is one of the few places where you can get that kind of content, you know, then everybody who comes there maybe comes for a reason. Or not maybe everybody, but
most people, so yeah, that again is your branding of your particular content with your university.
Because there are even, like, famous courses at universities, you know. I mean, just because you and I are both Glasgow graduates, we talk about the Glasgow courses. But, you know, there's a famous Exploring the Cosmos course that used to get taught in the physics department. And that was, like, known the university over as a very popular first-year physics course that covered a lot of the kind of cosmology and stuff like that. You can see more of that kind of thing. Perhaps, you know, maybe we're talking about superstar academics. You know, when you think about, you know, I'm thinking about people like, you know, Nick Bostrom is one of the sort of leading people in the debate about AI safety, for example, from Oxford University. He's, you know, he's very well known outside just the, his academic field. You know, when you think of other people in that area, you think, is that?
They're going to be people that capture the public's imagination.
You got your Professor Brian Cox and yes, people like that.
Exactly,
know.
Yeah. Yeah.
People who've been on the BBC. You know?
Yeah, and I think the thing is, like some people, even from just filming our MOOC, you know, mm-hmm. the media people said to us, oh, that guy, he's got it.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, you know, and I looked at his video and I thought, yeah, do you know what? He has it, but it's mm-hmm. almost undefinable. Mm. But you could tell just looking at all the 50 videos, that one guy, he is the communicator.
We're literally talking about the X Factor for our
Yes, that's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Oh but that's goodness. What's going to make something popular. That you know, yeah. that's what's going to be the marketing tool, yeah. is the guy that can communicate whatever the, you know, the particular topic is.
Yeah.
That's
so suppose we're in the situation right now, I feel, where we're sort of looking for the breakout MOOC.
Yep. Yes. That you know. Becomes
yeah.
almost like the BBC documentary or the thing that goes viral.
Yeah.
You know, and effectively YouTube kind of thing. You know, the thing yeah. that millions of people watch,
mm-hmm.
Which I think we've yet to see. I don't think.
Yeah.
Some of them have been exceedingly mm-hmm. successful, but I think they tend to be ones that maybe cater for things that people really want. You mm-hmm. know, not that many people want to know about cancer, so it's a small target audience. But hundreds yeah. of people want to know how to pass their IELTS exam.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that one was popular. Yeah. That's catering to a big.
How to get into Oxford and Cambridge?
Yeah, that's what we need to make on next.
Yeah.
Or something that people really want to understand. Mm. That's maybe a big deal in the media at that time, or
yeah.
you know, something that's.
I certainly see quite a lot of topical iTunes U courses coming in.
Right.
You know, more from the States and more from actually non-universities,
mm-hmm,
sort
mm-hmm.
of like government agencies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of a good example. With some of the smaller, more private universities mm-hmm. in the US, they tend to have iTunes U courses pop up about things that are topical. You know,
yes.
like introduction to North Korea. Or whatever,
yes.
at a time when North Korea is in the public eye, or when there's an anniversary or something, you know, mm-hmm. it's, you know, the legacy of the Kennedy administration or something
yeah.
like that. And some of the smaller universities seem to be a little bit more agile about the topical stuff.
Yeah,
that
they can quickly create some content. Yeah.
Or maybe it's just the iTunes U people promoting mm-hmm. things based on certain things, certain timing
yeah.
or whatever,
mm-hmm.
which is fine too. I mean, maybe, mm-hmm. maybe that's another way through.
Yeah, I think the thing with that, Glasgow did a same time as our MOOC, did one on issues and warfare kind of thing.
Mm.
I can't remember its exact name. And they took three topical issues. I think one was maybe Iraq. I can't remember. Yeah. One was Guantanamo Bay. I can't pronounce
Guantanamo
it.
Bay.
Guantanamo Bay. And so they took really topical issues mm-hmm. at the time, but they haven't rerun it because they said now there's no demand for those issues. That there was back at that time, and for them to rewrite it on three topical issues now would involve huge amounts of work.
Yeah.
So there just wasn't the.
Yeah.
It didn't really work out from a marketing point of view from that, you know, because they can't use it again.
It's interesting, you know, that we talk about that all the time, you know, teachers want a payoff
yes.
over multiple years
yeah.
for the investment
uh-huh.
of time.
All that
but,
work.
Which is completely fair, I think, just
oh,
because
yeah.
of the absolute
uh-huh.
effort
yeah.
that is,
yeah.
is required to make that kind
yep.
of material, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a massive amount of effort.
Yeah.
When you added up, we wrote away, you know, added up all our hours that we'd said that we had put into the MOOC. You know, we got a reply back and said, I don't believe you, just because it seemed so
it's
humongous.
The amount. Seemed a little bogus.
It
yeah.
seemed utterly ridiculous, the amount of time
yeah.
we'd put into it. But
yeah.
in order, that's the other thing, in order to create a high-quality product that isn't just somebody sitting with a camera
yeah.
in their office, you need to invest huge amounts of time. I suppose
yeah.
it's like any kind of teaching. For something that's high quality, you need to invest a lot of time in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to get something high quality that's just been flung together
yeah.
in 2 minutes. But
of course, now you're teaching 10 times the students while sitting
yes.
on the beach.
That's
drinking
right.
a pina colada, right?
Yeah,
that's
totally.
How it works. Yeah.
Yep. How much?
Yeah. So, Leah, just last question, mm-hmm. I think, just to kind of think a little bit further about this. How do you see, like, informal learning?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to... It seems to me that what MOOCs are doing is they're appropriating the tools of informal learning,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but trying to do formal learning with it.
Mm-hmm, yeah, yep.
You know, you're talking about chunking things to roughly the same size as a uh-huh. YouTube video.
Yes, yes,
you
yeah.
know, and that was the first thing that came to mind when you were talking about 8-minute segments.
Yeah.
But that seems like the average
YouTube
video.
Yeah.
yeah.
So how do I see informal learning progressing?
I guess what I don't know what I'm really asking with that question. I think. I'm just fascinated by the fact the existence of YouTube
mm-hmm.
and not just the existence of like the usual TV shows on
mm-hmm,
YouTube
mm-hmm,
or the reality content or
mm-hmm.
whatever, but also the genuine
mm-hmm.
academic potential that platform specifically.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, just looking even at, you know, doing a bit of, having done a bit of physics teaching within a school context over maybe 3-4 years now, in the past year, I've been amazed at how the quality of some of the stuff on, for example, YouTube, simply because there's been time for people to amass and make really good videos covering, say, as the GCSE content in this instance, that I feel I'm making much more use of now in school teaching, but also in university teaching. I find myself in lectures in the Moodle, which is our sort of class Blackboard, much more referring back to videos that I'm finding on YouTube.
Yeah.
Rather than creating a whole lot of content myself, because I think you obviously have to be really discerning in what it is you're using, but I think that it can save so much time that you can then put into one-to-one contact with the student that I think it would be ridiculous not to make use of that.
Yeah.
What I'm not certain that we're very good at doing yet is enabling students to find their own or make their own best use of informal content. I think, I mean, everybody obviously will just Google, take the first hit and look at that. I think we need to train our students much more. And we've looked at it a bit, I've done a bit of research on it, how to try and train them to, which I'm sure you're doing in school, to evaluate content.
Yeah.
But I think even, you know, although presumably kids are getting that through school now, at university level, we are still seeing some kind of mental block with regards to evaluating content, you know. So although there's all this kind of informal content out there, we need to teach them and we need to ourselves be aware of what it is we want to use.
And I suppose what you're seeing over the past maybe year or two, I think, is also the rise of more trusted brands on YouTube.
Yes.
Because I think, you know, people of our age, you know, we use YouTube as the thing that's at the end of a Google search.
Yes.
You know, we searched for something and we saw a video and we went and watched it. Whereas I think younger users of YouTube are much more focused on the channels aspect. And I think that's something that potentially is might cut that knot a little bit.
Yes.
Is that if we can find trustworthy channels on YouTube, you know, however formal or informal those channels are, you know, there's things like Numberphile, for example, is one, and there's a lot of kind of education channels on YouTube now that are focused on science or maths or chemistry or whatever. And maybe that's how we, maybe we have to relearn YouTube a little bit.
Yeah, because to us, it is, it's just a massive collection of, you know, stuff. Yeah, whereas we actually need to be able to know how to navigate it almost, like by using channels rather than just here's, you know, a billion videos that you can select any one from.
Yeah, we just look at it like a big pile of videos.
Yeah, yeah.
And one's the same as the next.
Yeah.
But I think it's true, isn't it, that like evaluating videos is much harder than evaluating text.
Oh, yeah, infinitely.
Much more
time-consuming. Yeah, yep. I mean, I hate it. I hate doing it. Having had to do it a lot, it's not...
Yeah. It's actually my least favourite thing about the iPad is that the iPad version of YouTube doesn't support 2x speed up.
Right, okay.
Which you can do on the web. You can do it on the desktop version, but you can't do it on the iPad.
Oh, wow.
Which, just doubles the time that it takes you to
see. I do all mine on on the actual screen. You know, I'm not evaluating them on iPad. So
yeah, when I use them in school, I'm mostly evaluating them for not being rude at any point.
Yes, totally.
Which is, of course, another whole other discussion. Well, it seems like a brave new world.
Yes, very much.
Coming
so.
Slowly, but you know, it seems like, I mean, none of these are unsolved technical problems.
No.
You know, we're now at a stage, I think, of development of the internet and computers where, at least for now, the things that we want to deliver that way are trivially done.
Yeah, yep.
You know, we can scale up to that.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of how do we do the assessment right? How do we do the, how do we change the pedagogy? How do we split up our content to go from large chunks of time to very short chunks of time? I mean, we've been using one... we've been using the Pixar in a Box course from Khan Academy, which is their kind of MOOC about computer graphics and 3D graphics. And it's very much like that. It's like 4 minutes here and then a reactivity and then 3 minutes and an activity. And I think what their interactive tools are still a little bit basic, but the kids can actually get a 3D model on their iPad and start to manipulate the control points and things. And there's actually a bit more kind of active working in there rather than just read a bunch of stuff or watch a video and then answer some questions.
And answer some questions, yeah, you're actually doing something.
So, I mean, I'm doing that with like 10 and 11 year olds.
Yeah.
And they're really getting into it. So it's a very, very well done example of that for younger users. A lot of the stuff I've seen, you know, that you said are also quite, perhaps a little bit more advanced, sort of upper secondary school into university time.
Yep.
But it'll be interesting to see how people start to do that for younger
and
younger
users. And I think that's coming,
Very. So eventually schools will just be computers and a security guard.
That's right. Lots of kids sitting at computers,
There certainly are schools like that. I mean, you've heard of the School of One in New York?
No.
Which is a school like that where the computer programs the kids' timetables. And every day they get to come in and they get told sort of, I don't know if they get told where to go, but they sort of get told what to sit down and do.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all kind of managed for them at a high level, you know. So I don't know how I feel about that. But then you've got the social question as well, don't you?
Yeah, is that an ideal environment to develop in?
Yeah. And even extend that up to the university level, you know. I mean, do you end up seeing a world where the rich and privileged get to have the on-campus experience and the poor people get to do it online?
Get to have
the, and the actual social networking in the old sense that happens on campus, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
Getting drunk with the future prime minister and having a story to tell about what he did in the old days.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen. Or does that happen online? You know,
quite possibly. You know, what did the prime minister put on Instagram when he was 19? Much to think about, I think.
Lots to think about, definitely.
But Leah, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's
been really
great
to talk
about it.
Thank you.